Happy New Year, and welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. In this episode, the first of a two-part special, we feature the insights of Pulitzer Prize-winning author Ron Chernow. His latest book, Mark Twain, was published by Penguin Random House in May 2025. Chernow has chronicled the lives of such influential men as Alexander Hamilton, Presidents George Washington and Ulysses S. Grant, and Titan John D. Rockefeller. Ron Chernow was interviewed by fellow biographer and Bio member John, better known as Jack, Farrell.
We're here today with Ron Chernow, a Pulitzer Prize winner, National Book Award, summa cum laude at Cambridge and Yale. But I think what most impressed me as a son of Long Island was most likely to succeed at Forest Hills High School. What was that, 1970?
1966.
1966. Okay. Clearly, Ron, you're one smart guy. And the thought occurred to me, since there's a theme of finance and the economy running through most of your books, why did you not end up on Wall Street making the money rather than writing about J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller and the other robber barons who had hit it big?
You know, there's a story, Jack, possibly apocryphal, that Karl Marx's mother said to him, "Karl, when will you stop writing about capital and make some?" And while I think that I can write clearly and intelligently about finance, I could never have been a financial wizard. In fact, one of the reasons after I finished the Rockefeller book that I stopped writing about business and finance is I found that when I would do a talk, invariably someone in the audience would stand up and say, "Mr. Chernow, should I turn over my three-month treasury bill?" People started asking me for financial advice. And I thought to myself, Jesus, if they actually saw my track record in terms of investment, they would be horrified. And so, you know, the people that I've written about in the financial and industrial world interest me intellectually. I never aspired to socially be part of that world at all. I think I would be, you know, very, very uncomfortable. In fact, I think one reason that I did well with the Morgan family, the Warburg family, the Rockefeller family, is that they never sensed that I was some kind of social climber who was interested in using these books to advance myself socially at all. And I have found that periodically I like to try to change direction, not only to surprise my readers a little bit, but to stay fresh. So I don't think that Wall Street missed anything that I did not go into some investment bank. But when I did the House of Morgan, it was interesting because at the time I wrote it, Michael Lewis was doing Liar's Poker and Brian Burroughs was doing Barbarians at the Gate. And there were suddenly a lot of books about Wall Street, and they were all contemporary books. And there was only one period in my adult life when I had a grown-up 9-to-5 job for 3 years. In my early 30s, I worked at a public policy foundation called the 20th Century Fund. And I really thought that that was my exit strategy from the writing world. I had wanted to be a novelist. I wrote a novel that didn't sell. I could not get a contract for a nonfiction book. I had been working as a freelance magazine writer for 9 years. It was very, very widely published, but I always sense that I was more the marathon man than the sprinter. I guess history has borne that out with these long books. But I really felt that my career was not working out, and that I went to the 20th Century Fund figuring, well, I'll go into the nonprofit world, the foundation world, where I had this idealistic notion, you know, that people were kind and pure hearted. And of course, it turned out to be as ruthless as any other segment of the world. But while I was there, I was actually supervising public policy books. And I had to pick an area of specialization. I chose finance because I had written a lot of articles as a freelance magazine writer about finance. I was reading a lot of Wall Street history. And this was the period when I was reading and then writing was the Great Reagan bull market on Wall Street, and Wall Street was
The greed is good days.
greed is good days. And
Yeah.
also Wall Street was dominated by all of these razzle dazzle conglomerates. And I'm reading about the old Wall Street of the early 1900s, when it was this very closed, secretive, discriminatory private partnerships. And I was very, very interested in how that world had turned into the world that, we were living in the 1980s. And so I got this idea, and it turned out to be a good one, that instead of just writing a straight history of Wall Street, that I would take a family or firm, and just by telling their story through that prism, the reader would see the entire history of Anglo-American finance. Once I raised the question of which family or firm would work, I was very quickly led to the House of Morgan, because the House of Morgan had been central to everything happening Anglo-American finance over a 150-year period. And that book was a tremendous turning point in my life in all sorts of ways. Now, I always say, Jack, to young writers, the two big questions in any writer's life: you have to find your voice, and you have to find your material. And very often the two go together. And when I started doing the House of Morgan, everything that I've written about in my adult life has been self-taught. I did 2 degrees in English literature. I did not study history. And so when I started doing the House of Morgan, I was actually looking at books to see how books were made. Oh, this table of contents, there's this text. I see there's an acknowledgement section. There are footnotes in the back. I was really teaching myself how to do it. And for several months, I was meeting with the publicists of J.P. Morgan and Company, asking for access to their historical records. And they kept hemming and hawing. And then one day I'm reading a book, and I see that there's a footnote to the Thomas W. Lamont papers, Harvard Business School Library. So at that point, I was so naive about historical methods, I didn't realize that there was this whole universe of manuscript collections, at thousands of universities and libraries and archives around the world. So I very innocently called up the Harvard Business School Library and said, "Do you happen to have the papers of a Thomas W. Lamont?" Thomas W. Lamont was the senior J.P. Morgan partner in the 1920s and 1930s. So I said, "You happen to have papers of Thomas W. Lamont?" And the woman laughed, and she said, "Oh, that's one of our largest collections." So I said, "Well, how many documents do you have?" And she laughed again and said, "Oh, about 100,000." And here I was having all these meetings with the Morgan Bank that somehow imagined that they still control their historical papers. But actually, as all of these people from the partnership era died off, they or their heirs would donate tens of thousands of documents to these libraries, usually their alma mater. So needless to say, I was like on the next plane to Boston. And my first day going through the Thomas W. Lamont papers, I read his complete correspondence with Benito Mussolini, Franklin Roosevelt, Charles Lindbergh, and Nancy Astor. That was just my first day. And I can remember that night, I was so excited. It was a warm September evening, and I was walking around Cambridge, Mass after dinner, and these characters were buzzing around in my head. I couldn't get them out. I was so excited. And I suddenly stopped and said to myself, "Oh my God, this is the way that a true novelist must feel about his or her creations." But that had never happened to me when I wrote fiction. And I had this discovery that I had the same emotional and imaginative reaction to real people and real events that I imagine a novelist has to his or her creations. So I suddenly realized I'm in exactly the right place. I had found my métier. And then I think I was so excited by the material, and then that came out in the narrative voice as well. Against, voice and finding voice and material are so often connected. But I not only suddenly wanted to do that for the rest of my life, but I thought to myself, "Hey, maybe I could even be good at this." By that point, I was around my mid-30s, so I felt that things were happening late in my career. I don't necessarily feel that way looking back, but I certainly did, at the time. And after that, I never looked back.
Not to gloss over the intervening books, but was it finance that brought you to Hamilton?
Yeah,
No.
I've had a strategy, if that's the right word. I've had a strategy as of a writer from the beginning, of not only wanting to have a readership. And what I mean by that is I wanted to have a group of readers who were loyal and who would follow me from book to book. And so I would always have that ideal reader in mind. And so I would try with each book that it would segue in some way from the previous book. So as I said before, the House of Morgan and the Warburgs, Titan, the Rockefeller biography, then I did a small collection of essays called Death of the Banker. I was beginning to feel trapped by this stereotype of me as the financial guy.
That's
And it was just one part of my life, and I'm not even sure the biggest part of my life. So Hamilton was an ideal subject for me because on one hand, there would obviously be enough finance to interest all of the people who had read my previous book. So it would seem to form a logical connection that I would be going back to the very origins of what I had written about. At the same time, it would open up an entirely new, field of study for me. Of course, I'd have to do the American Revolution, Constitutional Convention, the creation of the federal government. With Hamilton, I would have a lot of constitutional law. I would have foreign affairs and all different kinds of statecraft. So that was wonderful to me because I think that I ended up having this career because I wanted to be a perennial student. I love the idea that I'm constantly learning new things. A friend once said to me, said, "Ron, you've created your own Ron Chernow University where you're the sole, you have the sole endowed professorship." There. It's not a bad image because, like when I was in Cambridge, I did a second English degree there. And once a week, I had to go in and read an essay aloud to my tutor. And then I started writing magazine articles and then I started writing these books. So there's been a continuity in my life. I've always felt that I've had some kind of writing project, but I really want to grow intellectually. I think that at this point, I probably have covered most of American history at one time or another. And I think that because what I've written about has been self-taught, I think that if there's an enthusiasm in the book that people pick up, it's that I'm excited about discovering things and I'm excited about conveying that to people. And I think that had I studied history in school, if some history professor had told me how to regard this character or this, event, the writing might not have been as fresh. But I remember when the House of Morgan came out, Jack, one of the first reviews said, "This is a fine revisionist history of the House of Morgan." I was not entirely clear what history I had revised.
So, did you grow up in a house with a lot of books?
There were some books. I have to say that neither of my parents went to college. My father was a storekeeper in Chinatown in New York. My mother was a bookkeeper, but neither went to college. They were both extremely bright. My father grew up in an immigrant family on the Lower East Side, seven people living in one room. My mother had a somewhat more middle-class upbringing. They were both readers in different ways. My father was constantly reading newspapers and magazines, particularly the business press. And he had a very, very retentive mind for factual information. I probably inherited that. But I never saw him read a single book. My mother was a great reader of fiction. And there was no one whom I enjoyed talking about fiction more than my mother because she would talk about the characters in a novel as if they were friends and family. And she would just discuss them with curiosity and sympathy and intelligence. It wasn't literary criticism at all. And that's always the way that I've kind of liked to read and regard characters in fiction with that kind of intimacy. And, with my Mark Twain book, I dedicated the book to my parents. They're not alive, but it astounds me when I look back that I went through the public school system in New York before Yale. Here I go to two very fancy schools. Any other parents would have been saying to me, "Ron, you could have a very cushy life on Wall Street or in some law firm." I never once heard that from them. They were so entirely supportive, and particularly as I embarked on this freelance magazine career, there's nothing riskier. And I was barely covering my expenses, but they were so proud of every article that I did. And when I look back, I love them. I applaud them because I found out subsequently that there were a lot of people in the family who were calling up my parents and saying, you should stop Ron from doing this. He's marching off a cliff. You're going to regret it in later years. I'm glad that things worked out. I can understand why they had that, that fear, the number of writers.
Did they live long enough to see you be a great success?
Yes, they lived through, there's that line in Proof Rock, I measure out my life in coffee spoons. Is that, I measure out my life in the biographies. So they died around the time, a little bit after the Rockefeller book. So they didn't get to see Hamilton and all of the other, but I think that they saw enough to see the direction of my career in life and that I was actually going to make a go of it, and that they were, right to encourage me. No one else in the broader family who, I mean, not to do it. No one ever apologized about that. But I just feel very, very lucky. I sometimes feel as writers, I had worked for 3 years as a magazine writer in Philadelphia. I wrote for the Philadelphia Inquirer Sunday magazine, and I was just starting out. I was 24, 25, and we had an old-fashioned press club there, and we used to meet. We formed a writers group, and we used to meet at this old-fashioned press club once a month. We felt very grown up, and there were probably about 50 or 60 of us, and it was very democratic small day. It was very egalitarian because we were all just starting out. We were all aspiring, so we were all on the same level. And I was curious what would happen to this group. And I think of the 50 or 60 people, maybe two or three of them ended up really supporting themselves as writers. It's a little bit like the New York Marathon. It starts out with 40,000 people on the Verrazano Bridge, and then, two or three hours later, people are fainting and crossing the finish line. It's a long haul. So I just feel, in so many ways, extremely, extremely fortunate that I was able to do this. Needless to say, I didn't go into it for the money. There were much easier ways, to make a living than that. And so I just really wanted to support myself as a writer. And I just feel very, very happy that I've been able to do that and do these books that I love, each one quite different.
Now, when you got to the revolution, to the founders, fathers, period, have you come away with any lessons that, particularly in our time of trials now, it's good to think back upon? I mean, but both those guys are very interesting, Hamilton and Washington, but they're not the same person.
No, they form an interesting composite person, which is why the relationship was so successful. Hamilton had extraordinary intelligence, but no judgment. Washington had great judgment and kind of middling intelligence. He was smarter, I think, than most people imagine, but he was somebody who, when presented with a set of options, which Hamilton could present to him, would always pick the right one. So they formed a perfect combination. But so often, whenever I talk about Hamilton, Washington, someone in the audience will get up and ask Mr. Chernow, what would the founders, think of what's happening now? And my reaction always is they were not a monolithic bloc. They were fighting about the exact same issues we're fighting about today: states' rights versus, federal rights, congressional versus executive power, strict construction of the Constitution versus liberal construction of the Constitution, on and on and on. So, they bequeathed to us a set of questions, really bequeathed to us a set of conflicts that we're still fighting about. And so I've tried to resist an idealized view of the founding era because it was not only partisan. All of our founders hoped that we would be spared the bane of what they called factions and what we call political parties. But already during Washington's presidency, Hamilton and Jefferson started fighting. And even Washington, who's trying to levitate above the fray, by the end of his second term, he's already pretty much openly a Federalist on Hamilton's side. And so it was nasty. It was partisan. It was rough and tumble. And so we've been there before. I don't know if we've been there to quite the same degree we are at the moment. But I think there are a lot of people who like to read about the founding era and are kind of, searching for, golden age. And they were extraordinary intellects. They were really philosopher kings, and it's hard not to write about them without, walking away with tremendous admiration for them. But they were defining positions often in conflicts that are still with us.
Let me push you further. Having the demagogue president that they, especially in the constitutional period, were most worried about, and that Washington rejected in his behavior, and that Hamilton and Madison rejected in their arguments in the for the ratification. So, are there lessons there that we need to take quite seriously?
Well, actually, Hamilton, even though Hamilton was always accused by the Jeffersonians of being a closet monarchist, we have some of our most eloquent warnings of populist demagogues from Alexander Hamilton, said that this was their great fear of the strong man. Sometimes they would call it the man on horseback. In fact, Washington was so beloved because usually in history, the victorious general at the end of the war would then parlay that into political power. Instead, George Washington ends up surrendering his commission and becomes famous for relinquishing power. And Washington's greatness, I think, was that he didn't grasp for power, and the people trusted him because he didn't seem to be grasping for power. Now we have a president who's in love with power, and there's clearly a portion of the public that doesn't seem to, mind that at all. But, obviously, having written about Hamilton and Washington, I've thought about a lot about that era in relation to the present. And, our founders created these beautiful documents and these beautiful institutions. They did not think that the Constitution would last long. I mean, there's the famous Ben Franklin line when he emerged from the Constitution convention, and a woman asked him, "What have you created in there?" And he said, "Republic, madam, if you can keep it." And both Hamilton and Washington thought maybe it would last for 20 years. They always emphasized the importance of the amendment process because they said it was an imperfect document. They didn't see themselves as Roman sages in togas handing down these perfect institutions. But I think the Trump presidency has made us all see that a functioning democracy is more than a set of documents. It's more than institutions. It's more than a set of principles. There has to be a culture of democracy that people have to honor those institutions. You can't keep resorting to the courts, but the people have to voluntarily obey the law. If we have somebody who just feels that he is above the law and really heedless of the Constitution, where do we go with it? I mean, as we talk, Donald Trump recently tore down the east wing of the White House, and even though many people were shocked and dismayed by it, we have not really seen a response to it. So there are all these things that are happening that we never imagined would happen because we have always assumed that there was this culture of democracy and civility, that people would respect the institutions that our founders had bequeathed to us. But what happens if you come upon someone who has contempt for those institutions, doesn't really seem to, to care about it? And, it's been distressing, to put it mildly.
And to put him aside and just talk about the era, I mean, it seems I remember reading some of Jefferson's letters where he was complaining about the generation that followed and how all they were interested in was making money. And then after the great sacrifice of the Civil War, you had the era of the robber barons and the Roaring Twenties. And now it seems we've got a second Gilded Age is a very common metaphor for what we're living in. Is the corruption now much different than it was during the
It's an
Grant
excellent
era?
question. I just published the Mark Twain biography. It was Mark Twain who coined the term the Gilded Age. It was, of course, the title of his first book. And there are a lot of obvious parallels between that Gilded Age and what it is sometimes called the Second Gilded Age, our time. There were new technologies, spawned new industries, spawned colossal fortunes, spawned tremendous inequality and resentment and backlash, et cetera, et cetera. So there are a lot of obvious parallels, but I just kind of will point out one thing that's quite different and quite disturbing. the robber barons of the John D. Rockefeller era had a healthy contempt for politics. They tried to stay as far away as they could. Remember when I was writing about J.P. Morgan? I think there were only two times when J.P. Morgan met with the president. He met with Grover Cleveland during a dollar crisis. Then he met with Teddy Roosevelt during an antitrust crisis. Those are the only ones off the top of my head that I could remember. I was trying to remember, Jack, if there was a single time that John D. Rockefeller met with a US president. And unless my memory is faulty, I could not think of a single time. He wanted to stay as far away from politics as possible. Now, there were times I remember going through his papers that had to get a pipeline through the Maryland legislature, and they bribed the whole Maryland legislature. So, they were involved with politics when they needed to be involved from their point of view. But in general, it was a very lightly regulated, or in John D. Rockefeller's case, completely unregulated economy. And then there was the antitrust backlash. What's happening now that's very, very different and unsettling is the sight of the president sitting around with every major high-tech leader around the table. And he's had many meetings, not just in this administration, but in his first one, where he was just constantly surrounded by leaders of industry. Or if you look at his relationship with Elon Musk, now think of John D. Rockefeller, who wanted to stay as far away from the White House as possible. And then Elon Musk, who was like during that period where Doge was riding high, he seemed to be the second most powerful person in the country. So this is a disturbing alliance between big business and big government. And it's quite blatant, and I fear is going to stay with us. The government now is many, many times larger, obviously, than it was back in the Gilded Age of the 19th century. The government has its hands in many more industries, so it becomes, if you're a business person trying to maximize profit, it becomes that much more important to have all of these contacts with a government. But this has really been an unholy alliance of big business and big government that I fear may be with us for a while. And there's just obviously a lot of back scratching going on.
And we have faith that inevitably the cycle will change and there'll be a progressive or a populist response.
We both have written a lot about politics, and we know the 60s could not have been more unlike conservative 50s. The 70s could not have been more unlike the 60s. And I used to actually, when I was at Yale, even as I was out marching against the Vietnam War, I actually used to worry that we were going to turn into a one-party state, the one party being Democrat, because there was scarcely a single Republican on the Yale campus. I didn't need to worry. But fast forward 15, 20 years, suddenly there were all of these young conservatives on campus, and Reagan was in the White House. So there's always the turn of the screw. But exactly what form it will take, I don't know. I think the Democratic Party at the moment, it's in a position not unlike before Bill Clinton came along and before Barack Obama came along, sort of waiting for someone who will not only lead the party, but in some way kind of reposition it in the political system to make it more appealing to the majority of Americans. And in the case of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, they obviously had extraordinary political gifts to be able to do that.
Okay, so I'm going to skip over all the gloom and doom about the publishing industry and ask you to talk about any writer's wet dream, which was the day that the phone rang and somebody named Lin-Manuel Miranda said, "Hi, I'd like to option your book." Tell us that story.
Well, that was the fall of 2008. I was living in Brooklyn Heights at the time, and I was out for my Sunday constitutional, and I ran into my friend Garrow, whose daughter had gone to Wesleyan with Lin-Manuel Miranda. So I said, "Garrow, what's new?" And he said, "What's new? My daughter and I know this hip-hop guy, Lin, and he's read your Hamilton book, and become obsessed with it." So he put me in touch with Lin. Lin was still starring in his first musical, In the Heights, at the same theater, the Richard Rodgers Theater, where Hamilton is today. So I liked the show. I went backstage and we had this memorable conversation where I said to him, "So I got my book made an impression on you." And he said, "Ron, I was reading the book on vacation in Mexico. And as I was reading it, hip hop songs started rising off the page. I need to say this was not a typical reaction to one of my books. And one thing that I think the biographers in the audience, will find interesting: the book came out in 2004, did very, very well, and it was optioned 3 times for a feature film in Hollywood. And every time the word came back from Hollywood, "American history is boring. There's no mass market for a movie about American history. The public finds it tedious." And nothing ever happened. And then suddenly I met Lin-Manuel Miranda, and Lin told me that after he had read about 30, 40 pages of the book, he found the story just of Hamilton's childhood and adolescence in the Caribbean so extraordinary that he figured, oh, certainly someone must have done a musical about this. And he started clicking around. And to his amazement, there had never been a musical about it. So it was very nice after having dealt with these Hollywood people who were just blind to what I thought the most extraordinary dramatic story. And then Lin, I didn't have to sell him. He had already sold himself. He saw the whole thing in a blinding flash. And he asked me at that first meeting to be the historical consultant to this as yet non-existent show. And I left and I said, "You mean you want me to tell you when something is wrong?" And he said, "Yes, I want the historians to take it seriously." So I signed on. Of course, there's a lot of dramatic license in the show. And I signed on not because I thought this was going to be a sensation, because it seemed so offbeat and unconventional that that was the last thing on anyone's mind. But I've been a lifelong theater goer, and I thought, oh, wouldn't that be interesting just to follow the development of a show from the other side of the footlight? Of course, it was a thousand times more interesting than I had imagined.
And it helped sell the book.
Oh, gotcha. But what happened? That the very first preview, it originated at the Public Theater downtown. People started coming up to me in the theater afterwards, and they all were saying the same thing. They said, "Ron, I love the show, but as I was watching the show, I was embarrassed by how little I knew about the history of my own country, and I'm going to change that." So, fortunately for me, a lot of them
Right.
started reading and started with my book. So, yes, it certainly did lead to sales, but I had not exactly expected that reaction. But that turned out to be a pretty typical one. And I think that if there's one thing that Lin-Manuel and I have done a truly good deed, it's that at an important moment, we've gotten a lot of Americans reading history. And also, what I would hear people, I'm sure, Jack, you hear this, as well. When you do events, people will come up to you during the signing and they'll say, "Gee, Mr. Farrell, I wish I'd had a history teacher like you." They'll start telling you how boring their history class was, which was a shame. And so I think that if indeed the musical has gotten a lot of people reading American history, I think it's really important, because I fear historical amnesia more than anything else.
There's a great clip somewhere of him appearing, not with the cast at the White House, just by himself with the pianist.
That was 2009. He had written just that one song,
And
and
they ask him, "What's your show about?" And he says, "Well, it's a hip hop about the Secretary of Treasury." And they switch to Obama and Michelle, and they sort of sitting there going, laughing nervously, like, "Oh my God, this is going to be awful." And by the time he's finished the first song, they're sitting there snapping their fingers and clapping.
no, in fact, Barack Obama said afterwards that when he heard that line, a hip hop song about Alexander Hamilton, his reaction was, "Good luck with that." But then Lin-Manuel sends me this email. He said, "I just performed it at the White House." So I go on YouTube, and there he's not only performing the one song he's written at the White House, but he's getting a standing ovation from the President and First Lady. And I thought to myself, "Wow, I'm really strapped to a rocket with this guy." He's already performed it at the White House and gotten a standing ovation. It's like, where do we go from here?
That was award-winning author Ron Chernow speaking with fellow biographer and bio member Jack Farrell via Zoom in October 2025. Chernow's latest book, Mark Twain, was published in May of last year by Penguin Random House. And the second half of this conversation between Chernow and Farrell will be available next week. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Eliane Marie Fillengaines created our theme music. Jenny Skoog is our producer, Carolyn Van Putten, assistant producer, and Cherie Newman is our engineer. I'm executive producer Sonya Williams. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.